The Government Gurus is a podcast developed by AP Government teachers designed to cover the new AP curriculum. The mission of the Gurus is to help teachers engage students through a thoughtful conversation on the material and to provide teachers with strategies to produce the best classroom experience for their students. So please join us on this exciting journey as we explore our constitution, its principles, and discuss the complex issues facing our society today.
Today we're speaking with Linda Monk, who's a constitutional scholar who's written several books and is a constitutional scholar, and book just came out recently called The Bill of Rights, A User's Guide. And we have been speaking, or I've been speaking with some of my AP colleagues, and they were very excited. I'm very excited to have such an esteemed colleague and scholar on our show to talk a little bit about her book and the Bill of Rights.
I'm happy to be on your show, Alex, and especially to talk to some students who are committing a lot of time and effort to learning more about our Constitution and Bill of Rights.
Yeah, and I have to give a shout out to one of my colleagues, Ross Bossy, who introduced me to your first book, The Words We Live By.
Yay, Ross!
Yes, and I'll tell them to listen to the first couple of minutes of this, because I had no idea, going through as a political science major, I had never heard of either of these books. So once it came out at Montpelier, he's like, oh, I have this book. I thought, oh my gosh, this is wonderful. And then, of course, you have the companion book now, The Bill of Rights. So I'm interested, and I think everybody's interested in, is this the first copy or is this a revised copy?
It's now in its, I'm proud to say, fifth edition. It actually was my first book. This originally came out a little over 25 years ago, and I'm proud to say won the American Bar Association Silver Gavel Award, its highest honor for law-related media, in the bicentennial year of the Bill of Rights. So this is the book that really kicked off my career. I'm very proud to say that Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg contributed a foreword, and turns out she and I have the same judicial hero, who is Judge Learned Hand, who said in a quote that I'm sure is familiar to your AP colleagues and students, that liberty lies in the hearts of men and women, and when it dies there, no constitution, no law, no court can save it. And I remember as a third-year law student at Harvard, sitting in the law library thinking, well, what do I want to do with this degree? And I enjoyed writing, and I enjoyed opinion writing, particularly, or writing for public opinion, I should say. And the light bulb went off in my head, the eureka moment of, we were taught in law that it's litigation, legislation, and public education are the three-legged stool. And I felt a call to public education, because the reality is, you know, if you study law, if you study the Supreme Court, you know that ultimately the power of the Constitution relies on we the people. That's just a truism. And the moment that the Constitution loses its impact with citizens who are willing to stand up for its principles, really doesn't matter if we have a Supreme Court or a Constitution. As Learned Hand, when he gave that quote, it was 1944, it was the middle of World War II, it was an I Am an American Day at a swearing in of naturalized citizens, and he knew Nazi Germany had a Constitution. But if those principles weren't being upheld by citizens, it really came to no avail.
Yeah, and when I read your book, I saw that quote, and I have to say that, you know, I have a student who's going to William and Mary, and she's excellent, and she had some doubts about her knowledge, and she got an award this year, and I put that quote.
Give her a shout out. Come on, we love giving shout outs to real names and real students.
Her name is Miranda Huffer, and she's just a phenomenal student. So I had given her that quote. I think she's just a tremendous student. She fights for injustice and, you know, embodied that quote so well. So,
and tell her the notorious RBG agrees with her. That's her, that she loves Learned Hand.
Yeah, RBG. Yeah, she's, I saw the, they sell now earrings and like a tie clip of that little necklace she wears during a dissent. And I mean, that has to be a phenomenal honor to have a Supreme Court justice where I teach, I had family members that are related to John Marshall, and I had a family member invite me to the Supreme Court for a John Marshall banquet, and I didn't get to meet, but I got to see the Chief Justice, and I thought that was an incredible honor. So I you know, this year I sat in on Carpenter versus U.S., but to have, I mean, to be able to have a Supreme Court justice with the history and integrity of Ruth Bader Ginsburg is just, I think, really powerful.
She's a very kind lady, and I highly recommend the new documentary that's out about her life. Again, whether you do agree or disagree with her current positions on the court, there's no question that she paved the way for both women and men to be treated equally under the law.
Yeah, she did. And through the ACLU, they did the Constitution Center did an interview, Jeffrey Rosen. And I listened to that, and it was very interesting to see how Ruth Bader Ginsburg talks, because she's very quiet and very slow, but very deliberate when she speaks. So it was fascinating to listen to it.
Well, that's what makes the whole Notorious RBG, and I'm sure your teachers and students are familiar with that, so funny, is because her real life personality is just totally different than that, except when she writes her dissents from the bench, when she's wearing that jabot, is what they call it, the collar, she's fierce.
She writes brilliant dissents, and I think my favorite one is with the Shelby County, where she says, you know, pulling away the voting rights is like putting away an umbrella in a rainstorm because you're not getting wet. I mean, just brilliant.
Yes, and having grown up in segregated Mississippi myself, I think she's spot on with that.
For me, with your book, I think looking at the text, and we had talked before, I think I've never seen a book on the Bill of Rights that I think is so user-friendly, laid out in a way that doesn't seem like a textbook, but seems like you can get a lot of good information. And I'm, you know, I should take a picture of my syllabus and send it to you, because it, recommended books are the words we live by in the Bill of Rights.
Oh, I appreciate that so much. I get a twofer from you. That's fabulous.
If I could make the two books for AP government, these would be it, with the Constitution and the Bill of Rights.
I appreciate that. It's interesting because the book, The Words We Live By, which it covers the entire Constitution, was actually my second book, but its approach was much different. It was much more distilled, much more concise. This book is designed to be accessible and clear, but it's a deeper dive. So you're gonna have 300 pages that are just on the Bill of Rights and the 14th Amendment, as opposed to the entire Constitution. But again, what I strove for in this book was to lay out the history of the Bill of Rights itself as both a concept and a document. And of course, I've got to give a shout out to my favorite founder, my boyfriend, Jimmy Madison. He's all mine. Everybody else is a stand-up. Actually, at one conference, another teacher and I were talking about we're going to get a backup group called the Madisonettes. You know, I think little Jimmy has not gotten his due, particularly in all this hoopla over Hamilton. So I want little Jimmy to get his fair share. And so I really go to great lengths to talk about Madison's role. And of course, we celebrate him as the father of the Constitution. We know he did all that intellectual heavy lifting, and also just he was the workhorse in the Constitutional Convention and afterwards. But the Bill of Rights is where I give him the most credit, because that was a concept where we know he was opposed to it originally. He, in the Virginia ratifying conventions, he stood up against Patrick Henry. Now that was a job. And then when it was clear the people of Virginia wanted a Bill of Rights or else they were not going to ratify the Constitution, he listened to the people. And when he ran for Congress, he made that part of his platform. And when he got to the first Congress, which we remember was in New York at that time, when he gives his reasons, this is toward the end of the convention in August, excuse me, the end of the drafting of the Bill of Rights in August, he said that one of his reasons for doing it is, I am an honest man. Wouldn't we like to hear that from all of our politicians? I am an honest man, meaning even though I might have been opposed to it at the beginning, the people want it, and I'm going to keep my promise to them.
Yeah, I would like an honest politician, but that quote you said reminds me of the movie Lincoln. And I when I show it at the end of the year, I always show the Tommy, when Tommy Lee Jones is sitting there And one of the, I can't remember, the politician says, talking about Lincoln, he's like, I don't trust him. And Tommy Lee Jones, he's like, trust? He's like, I'm sorry, I thought your chosen profession was politics. The humor in some of those spots is spot on. But so Madison writes the Bill of Rights, and it doesn't come out of the convention. So why not? We look at them today, and they're sacred. Right. We look at the Bill of Rights, especially now, I think, in the 2018, I think one of the most critical ones is probably the Second Amendment and free speech, whether it's Alex Jones, or I just read an article about liberal professors are starting to get fired on campuses, or Bill Maher, who's controversial, that doesn't speak. Those two, I think, seem to pop out. So why do you think Hamilton, the Federalists, were just, no, we're, you know, they don't have the power to do this. Why didn't they include them?
Well, as you know, historians still disagree about that. I'm not sure there's definitive evidence either way, except that we know for a fact that George Mason of Virginia made a motion late in the convention to add a Bill of Rights, and he states very clearly there that it won't take very much time. Well, how does he know? It's because he actually wrote the Virginia Declaration of Rights. And when we finally get our Bill of Rights, it's almost cut and paste of the Virginia Declaration of Rights. So when we say Madison was the author of the Bill of Rights, I usually say he was more the editor in terms of the content of them. But in terms of being the prime mover, and to me, that being his greatest political accomplishment, because it was clear, as we say, it came up in the convention. Mason proposed it, but it was defeated unanimously by state delegations. So, we look at it today kind of like the comedian Steve Martin would say, Bill of Rights, I forgot. Did they just forget it? No, they turned it down on its face. But then in ratification, when we the people get a chance to play more of a role, it becomes the chief stumbling block. And I think it became clear to many of the Federalists that they were going to have to adopt a Bill of Rights. The question was whether it was going to be before ratification of the Constitution or after. Most states went along with the idea of it could be after, except for the state where I live now, North Carolina, which was very clear about, no, we're not going to ratify this Constitution until it's already got a Bill of Rights in it. And as you know, the facts your students know and can easily find, but eventually the Bill of Rights is ratified. Virginia's the necessary state in December 15th, 1791. So those are all the little factoids. You want to go to some more of the merits issues now, or you want to talk a little bit more about the history of the Bill of Rights?
Well, it's up to you. I just love listening to you talk. So I've got some questions. I'm sure that the AP government teachers and even the students, I think, are curious, because I have students that have difficulty separating the Declaration of Independence and the Bill of Rights. And I think a lot of students...
Hey, when I get these questions about, well, students know this and students don't know that, I say, wait a minute, the adults don't know it.
If you look at, I always show jaywalking and... Well, there's a Stuart Harris had a woman on, I can't remember her name. She's writing a book called The Cult of the Constitution.
I think she's already come out with it, yeah.
And I'm really interested in that book because it talks about how people are very obsessed with bits and pieces of it and don't understand it, kind of like biblical terms.
In biblical terms, it's often talked about as biblical inerrancy, the idea that every word in the Bible is literally true. And some people take that same kind of approach toward the Constitution, that every word should actually mean, as Justice Scalia said often, what it meant in 1788 when the original Constitution was ratified, 1791 with the Bill of Rights, 1868 with the 14th Amendment. And he said not too long before he died that the 14th Amendment was not intended to cover women. And so women weren't covered, which came as a shock to about half the population.
Yeah. And he gets blasted for it. I'd have to say some of his things disagree. But since there's no universal interpretation, it's not like he's dead wrong. He has an originalist or textual, originalism and textualism a little bit different. But I mean, and he was, and he just, he stuck to it, whether or not you agree or disagree.
And I agree with, and let's be clear, and I hope you're already clear about this, that my books are written in a balanced fashion. My goal in writing these books is to present the best arguments where there are questions about interpretation, et cetera, to present the best arguments from multiple points of view. I really strive to be balanced. And I agree with Justice Scalia in many of his decisions, particularly in the First Amendment. He's outstanding on the First Amendment. The Fourth Amendment, he, from my point of view, can be good. I agree with him, actually, on the idea that the death penalty, if we want to stop the death penalty in this country, the best way to do it would be by constitutional amendment, because the Constitution clearly entertains the idea of a death penalty. It's in there, whether we like it or not. I use Justice Scalia, not that I always agree with him, but I always use him as a foundational reference point because he so clearly represents a certain school of interpreting the Constitution.
It's fascinating because I think him and Ginsburg were very, very close.
Oh, exactly. They both loved opera.
And they didn't let their judicial opinions, which, I mean, heck, if I'm at Thanksgiving, and my family's talking about politics, it's like, I can barely get through the dinner, and I'm sure they feel the same way about me at times. But
well, going back to what we were talking about the Bill of Rights specifically, I did want to mention, one of my favorite parts of the Bill of Rights book. I want to make sure that people have access to the book, know about it. It's page 27 and 28. I found a copy of the, and this goes back to original meanings and Justice Scalia, because I found a copy of the notes that the guy who was the official note taker for the House at the time of the Bill of Rights debates did. And it's got all kinds of cool drawings on it, a horse and a cowboy.
And some really neat. Why not? Kids are always saying.
Yeah, and exactly. And you think, okay, well, when we're talking about, and Justice Scalia would say, oh, I don't care about intent, but we still have to go through the notes of the debates to even know what words they were using. And whenever we rely on note takers, we're relying on human beings. And so for those who, like Justice Ginsburg, who opposed Justice Scalia's theory of interpretation, they would say, wait a minute, come on, from the beginning, judges have had to use judgment that's informed by reality on the ground too. For instance, like with the example of the Voting Rights Act. And if everything was as easy as original meanings, then we wouldn't be used as judges. We would be using historians and dictionary writers.
I listened to a podcast by Malcolm Gladwell called Revisionist History, and he talks about the Constitution, and he brings the Second Amendment, 26th Amendment, and he brings it to Grammarian, and she reads it, and she's like, the language on some of these bills, she says, it's just atrocious. Even the meanings, people have different ideas around them, and that's fascinating.
If you want to talk about the Second Amendment, that's a classic example. If you want to focus more on the First Amendment, I'm also looking at the time and knowing you're gearing this, I believe, for your students as well. So you tell me where we should be headed.
Let's shift gears then. And so we talked about the Bill of Rights.
Oh, the Declaration of Independence. Sorry, I didn't answer that question. And this is the thing when we kind of get going in our conversations. For those of us who are enthusiasts, we can go around the block 40 times. Anyway, there is a core answer, I think, in terms of the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights. And the way I refer to it, for those of you who are members of a particular religious faith, you're probably used to the idea credo, which means I believe. And the Declaration of Independence has one sentence in it that is our mission statement as a country. It's the credo. It's I believe we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by the Creator with certain unalienable rights. And then here's the kicker. And to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. To secure these rights, that governments are instituted. So if you look at the Declaration, it says, what do we want our government to do? We want it to secure our rights. But it doesn't give a remedy for those rights, doesn't even create a form of government. It's our second constitution that provides more of a remedy through independent courts for rights to be enforced. So the Declaration is our mission statement. The Constitution is our government manual our employer manual that says, okay, here's what you can do, here's what you can't do. And the Bill of Rights is kind of, and oh, by the way, just in case you were tempted to forget, we're going to spell out even more of these. And then, of course, we get later with the 14th Amendment and the whole idea that equality is introduced for the first time in the Constitution. But so I did want to answer that question. The whole thing about the Declaration of Independence is it does not create any legal remedy.
So why don't we move forward? I know we talked about one of the big things that, as for AP instructors, that we have to identify the difference between civil liberties and civil rights. And you and I had talked previously about that.
I can give you what I was taught was the textbook definition. And you tell me if it's still right, okay? But what the difference that I was taught was that civil liberties are what we think of as our traditional rights that are in the Bill of Rights, most notably freedom of religion, freedom of speech. People would include in that the Second Amendment right to bear arms. Those things that are really encapsulate what our liberties are as American people. Of course, remember that didn't include Native Americans, enslaved people, women, people without property for a long time. But then the civil rights were used to associating more the 1960s in terms of the civil rights movement. And what we saw there is that even though the Constitution protected the right of African American men and men of color to vote on the 15th Amendment 100 years later, and then later with women, but 100 years later, that still was not true, predominantly in the segregated South, but also in places in the North. And so there was this massive movement of citizens to say, wait a minute, we don't really have the civil liberties unless you give us our civil rights of being able to vote and be counted as a full citizen. So from my point of view now, I think the difference can be descriptive, but in some ways it can be artificial, because I agree with the civil rights leaders who said, wait a minute, if you don't have equality of voting, you don't really have equality or true protection of those civil liberties.
Because laws are passed by, you know, representatives and voters, and if you can't voice that opinion, then you're not part of the process.
And as was witnessed, I mean, you would be technically represented by a member in the legislature or the presidency, but not in fact, because like my native Mississippi, when I was growing up, there was massive, what we today would regard as fraud in terms of the way African Americans were being denied the right to vote.
Yeah, it's interesting. It reminds me of this idea of this virtual representation that England had. Said, oh, no, you don't have the vote, but you know, we'll take care of you. Don't worry. And the colonists are like, well, wait a minute. That's not one of the purposes of government. But if we don't have a direct voice and vote, then you're really not representing the people. And there's no check and balance on those representatives. Yet they turn around and think that that is perfectly legitimate. And then finally, do you think the Bill of Rights needs to be written, or do you think there needs to be an added amendment that addresses, and I'm not going to count the 27th as the pay, but do you think there's something that needs to be changed or identified?
I disagree with people who say that we should repeal. I've seen that mentioned, repeal the Second Amendment. No, I do not believe that we repeal it. I think what's happening is that we're not recognizing that the Second Amendment, like all other amendments in the Bill of Rights, has limitations. And that sometimes people who are arguing on behalf of Second Amendment rights are talking in absolute terms as though, well, it could never be regulated. It's like, wait a minute, every right in the Bill of Rights is regulated. So that's what we're talking about, is the extent of the regulation, not whether it should be regulated. In terms of a new amendment, this is something I feel very strongly about, that I do think we need a voting rights amendment to the Constitution, not just a Voting Rights Act, because as you know, and your students will learn, there is no explicit right to vote in our Constitution. In fact, the amendments that protect the right to vote don't do it directly. Say you cannot be discriminated against because of race or because of sex. But I think we need a very direct protection of our right to vote. Some of the things that we're used to hearing in the Voting Rights Act of 1965 I think should be constitutional protections for everyone. The idea that you don't change voting boundaries at the last minute, like they're trying to do in Georgia now in terms of polling places, shut down polling places at the last minute, all these kind of last minute decisions are ones that are going to impinge on people's right to vote. And instead of looking at so much what we're doing to limit people's right to vote, we should be encouraging that. And I think that if we have that as a firm constitutional standard, that's going to be a better protection.
I think, if I remember correctly, Jesse Jackson Jr. came to Central Michigan, and I think while he was in Congress, I believe that was him, there's no guaranteed right to vote, and he was trying to get that amendment passed, and that was in 99, 2000-ish. So I would agree that would be an amendment I would like to see, and I've seen articles about the Equal Rights Amendment trying, you know, only one more state, so it'll be interesting.
Well, and actually this North Carolina, I was just involved in some debates about that, may actually become the 38th state to ratify.
That will be very interesting to see. And I think it would be much needed because I think very similar to the Voting Rights Act, we do have laws protecting women and, you know, the Equal Pay Act, Fair Pay Act. I remember my mother telling me that when she was, you know, married to my dad, she couldn't have a checking account. She couldn't have a, you know, she couldn't do anything until like 1973, 1974 as a married woman. And I thought, well, we've got these laws, but it seems that there's ways around it. Maybe a constitutional amendment, just like the Voting Rights Act, would be something needed.
Well, a constitutional, I personally am in support of that because, you know, for 40 years since I went to law school, we've been thinking the 14th Amendment was going to protect women. And again, I want to say, and men, these are gender classifications that sometimes affect men, sometimes affect women. But to say that before the law, you should not be able to discriminate based on sex, we thought that was going to happen under the 14th Amendment. Justice Ginsburg led the way there. But it still is not true that women are still, and discrimination based on sex is still at a lower constitutional bar than discrimination based on race. But again, as African Americans and people of color will be clear to point out, it can be in the Constitution, still not mean a darn thing. The 14th Amendment was passed to bring some sense of equal protection laws to the former enslaved people. And for another 100 years, it meant virtually nothing to protect people of color. So again, I come back, I end where I started, which is Judge Learned Hand saying, liberty lies in the hearts of men and women, and when it dies there, no constitution, no law, no court can save it. And that's why I commend you and your colleagues and the students who are committing their time to take a deep dive into our system of government. And hopefully as a result of that, we'll fight very hard to preserve it.
I want to thank you very, very much. I was getting messages from teachers that I'm talking to Linda Monk today on Facebook and Twitter, and some of them are like, I'm so mad at you right now. I'm jealous. And it's nice that you are very well respected among the ranked AP government teachers.
I appreciate that very much.
And I'll give you a shout out. If you're interested, teachers, you can follow Linda Monk on Twitter at Linda R. Monk JD. You can follow the government gurus, the Gov Gurus, on Twitter. And Ms. Monk, thank you for coming on the show. I noticed that there's a big thing on the 14th Amendment in your book, and I would love for you to come back and talk about it.
Absolutely. I'd be happy to. You take care. Thanks.